next.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The prosecution rests its case, but the jury is still out. Yesterday, Colin Powell concluded his 80-minute presentation to the UN Security Council, complete with satellite photographs and phone intercepts, by reminding the body of what he said was its duty to act.
My colleagues, we have an obligation to our citizens. We have an obligation to this body to see that our resolutions are complied with. We wrote 1441 not in order to go to war. We wrote 1441 to try to preserve the peace. We wrote 1441 to give Iraq one last chance. Iraq is not so far taking that one last chance. We must not shrink from whatever is ahead of us. We must not fail in our duty and our responsibility to the citizens of the countries that are represented by this body.
But 24 hours later, the international response to Powell's speech is mixed, suggesting that to members of the UN Security Council, material breach is in the eye of the beholder. While U.S. allies like Britain heard in Powell's presentation enough evidence to make the case for action, other veto-bearing members of the Security Council, France, Russia, China, heard only a compelling case for more time, more inspections, more diplomacy. Connection listeners, did Secretary Powell make the case to you? And how important is it for the United States to secure U.N. backing before making the decision to go to war with Iraq? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me in the studio right now is Graham Allison. He is director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and also author of the seminal book Essence of Decision, which helped explain not only the Cuban Missile Crisis, but many of the factors that go into the decisions that people in government make. Welcome, Graham.
Pleasure to be with you.
We're delighted to have you, and we should also note that even as we speak, Secretary Powell is now on Capitol Hill testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I want to ask you about the multimedia presentation yesterday that we saw at the Security Council. There were audio tapes of telephone intercepts. There were satellite photos, probably brought you back a little bit to those famous shots of the missile silos in Cuba. There were diagrams. There were graphics. There were maps. Were they enough?
Well, I think the answer is yes and no, and let me say on both sides. I think it was a masterful presentation and a powerful case, but in the end, circumstantial rather than conclusive, providing confirmation for the converted, but not answering the deeper questions of the skeptical. So in the yes side, I think it'll turn out with the diplomatic initiative that the U.S. and Britain are now making, in the end, to be sufficient to get a second Security Council resolution authorizing action if that's necessary. So I think it'll be part of a successful story. But analytically, the skeptics will continue to worry about the unanswered questions, of which there were several.
Well, we were cautioned going in that there would be no smoking gun. You have to wonder, would it have taken a smoking cannon to convince some of the skeptics?
Well, I think one of the unanswered questions is, given the encyclopedia of intelligence information that Secretary Powell presented so well, why is the U.S. unable to find a smoking gun, that is to identify a facility where Hans Blix can go and open it up and find this material? I mean, one had even the presentation of a camp that was said to be producing sarin in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area, which actually happens to be an area in which the U.S. has unlimited influence. Even Bill Safire asked this morning, if we know where it is, why are we not bombing it? Okay.
Well, what do you think the answer to that is? Is it that we do have it, but we're unwilling to disclose it for intelligence reasons?
I've been going back and forth on this, and since I'm not on the inside, I can't tell. Initially, I thought because the statements made by the president and Secretary Rumsfeld were so definitive, I remember Rumsfeld said, we have bulletproof information, that I thought they knew where a smoking gun was and that they were going to lead Blix to a smoking gun and that this was going to therefore become the casus belli. As the story has gone on, it seems to me possible that while we know in our hearts, and I know in my heart, in my mind, I would say the chances are 99.99 that Saddam has chemical and biological weapons. So we're not arguing about that, per se, but that the ability to identify facilities where there's unambiguous evidence, maybe we have less, maybe there's no ace in this hole at the end of the game, and therefore the Secretary made as strong a case as he could make for the absence of that. But I think the French and others will continue to say, if you let the inspectors do their job, they're actually going to go to a facility where they're going to find chemical or biological materials, or these trucks, or this chemical production plant, or some other unambiguous evidence, at least of a gun, even if it's not smoking.
Well, as you say, some of the most skeptical watchers of all of this have been in Europe. We want to check in now with Peter Philipp, who is chief correspondent for Deutsche Welle Radio. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
And what's the reaction there?
Well, the reaction is very much as we just heard. It is circumstantial evidence which we were presented, and it doesn't really prove what has been claimed as bulletproof evidence for the past weeks and maybe months. And it is not very convincing, at least it's not convincing evidence to go to war now at this stage. It is more convincing to say, let the inspectors continue, let them continue to search for more material, and on the basis of this information, maybe go to the correct addresses and see if they can find anything. But it's like stopping a trial in between and saying, well, we have enough circumstantial evidence, let's get to the verdict. This wouldn't be done in court, so it shouldn't be done at the UN. This is the feeling in Europe, mainly in Germany and in France, although there's a difference of approach between both countries, but basically they take the same attitude at this presentation of Colin Powell, which I think is accepted with respect, because it was an impressive presentation, but it wasn't very convincing.
Peter, how closely has the average person in Europe been following this? Were people riveted to their TV sets, as many people in the United States were yesterday?
Yes, they were. It was broadcast live with simultaneous translation, and many programs, many TV stations and radio stations had it on their schedule. So lots of people followed it, and of course today the newspapers are full of it. And yesterday, until the late afternoon and evening hours, this was the top story in the German media and as well in the French media. So this is a top story because everybody here is concerned about the danger of having a war, and even if we are not going to be directly involved in this war, but everybody is afraid that there will be such a war with unpredictable consequences, and that's of course why everybody was very closely watching what was happening in the United Nations, not so much because it was Joschka Fischer, the German foreign minister, who was presiding, but really because everybody had this feeling that a lot depended on this presentation. And after the presentation, this expectation was somehow disappointed, because what we were given was not a part of what we had expected.
Peter, we thank you so much. We have to leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We turn now to Masha Lipman, who is deputy editor of the Russian weekly news magazine Journal. She's joining us on the line from Moscow. Hi, Masha.
Hi.
And how did it play there?
Quite unlike Germany, there is not, by far, not as much interest in this country. The reaction here is fairly restrained. The political elite in Russia knows very well that President Putin deems Russia's policy toward the U.S. Operation Iraq of very high importance, and that he is personally in charge. And this is why the political elite is cautious, and they generally refrain from making statements before they hear what the president has to say. Now, Putin himself has not spoken very much about the health issue. But last week he said that Russia's position may be hardened if Saddam Hussein creates problems for the inspectors. This is regarded here as the key statement made so far, and this gives grounds to believe that it's not likely that Russia may veto the U.S. initiative in the Security Council if and when it comes to the vote. What's important to Putin is what Russia may hope to gain from supporting the U.S., not how cogent the Colin Powell's argument was yesterday. Russia has oil interests in Iraq, and also Russia is concerned about oil prices after the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime. And there's another issue President Putin is interested in, and this is the possible endorsement of Russia's policy in Chechnya.
Speaking of those massive oil contracts, obviously of great interest to people at the official level, is that something that's generally known in the Russian public?
The public knows, but the public is generally very passive regarding the forthcoming U.S. operation in Iraq. Now, when asked in polls, people are not at all fond of Saddam Hussein, but they are mostly not pro-Bush either. Just today in a, I would say, generally liberal pro-Western radio program here, 75% of the listeners in a poll said they thought Bush was driven by his geopolitical interests, and only 25 thought he was concerned about the humankind and the danger of Saddam Hussein. And this is a liberal, pro-Western audience. More generally speaking, I think people think Bush is pursuing his own material interests, American oil interests, and he seeks to show the world who's boss.
Thank you so much, Masha Lipman, joining us on the line from Moscow. She's deputy editor of the Russian weekly news magazine Journal. Graham, what do you make of those responses?
Well, I think both of them were very much to the point. I think Masha's account of the Russian view that it's Russia's interests rather than the persuasiveness of the specific case and a fairly cynical interpretation of what the U.S. is about is consistent with my understanding of Putin and the political elites there. And I think from the German commentary, it seems again that that as a European perspective, at least for Germany and France and many others in Europe who were skeptical previously, I think reflects the problem that the Bush administration will continue to have to struggle with. Now, I think in that struggle, it's going to be looking to persuading people in all the ways that countries persuade their friends and neighbors, as opposed to simply rhetorical arguments and evidence. And
such as?
Well, I suspect that for France, which I think will be the longest holdout, but will in the end at least abstain, the question is more French interests, which include oil interests in the region and the ability to play a role after the war, and the hope that using the Security Council authorizing process as opposed to letting the U.S. strike out on its own alone will be a way of constraining the hyperpower as they think of the U.S.
All right. We are talking about the nation's and the world's response to Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech at the Security Council. You can call us, be part of the discussion at 1-800-423-8255. Give us your reaction. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said today that Iraq has not cooperated sufficiently on disarmament and that his next report to the UN will reflect his frustration and lend the nation...
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon this hour. We're talking about the speech Colin Powell delivered at the United Nations Security Council yesterday, getting reactions from around the world and the nation. You can join in the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And joining me in the studio today is Graham Allison, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Graham, I want to just briefly go over the threat that Secretary Powell outlined yesterday at the UN. He said there was enough anthrax there to kill several million people. VX, deadly chemical agent. Botulinum, I hope I'm pronouncing it properly. It's the single most toxic substance known. Munitions, 6,500 bombs are missing. Iraq has more than 30,000 munitions capable of delivering chemical agents. Also, biological weapons labs on wheels, longer-range missiles. I mean, it sounds like a pretty comprehensive list.
Well, I think that there's a long list of biological and chemical weapons that the UN inspectors who've been at this job or with that were at this job from 91 to 98 when they were kicked out developed. I don't think there's any debate in the expert community about the fact that Iraq had chemical and biological weapons, and there's no debate about the fact that they've not appropriately accounted for these weapons and materials, and therefore that they're likely to have them now. So I think Secretary Powell rightly pointed to Iraq as an ominous threat. Now, of course, Iraq has had such capabilities in the 1980s when they used gas against the Iranians and against their own people, the Kurds. They've had them in the 1990s. So what this doesn't answer is the question, why the urgency now? But the fact that Iraq and Saddam are bad actors who've been pursuing and having biological and chemical weapons is not, I think, an issue. And I think what Secretary Powell did is by focusing on that and emphasizing it and providing more fine detail, re-emphasize a point, but a point that I think is not debated or disputed. The people who are skeptical about the necessity for action now ask, one, is there something more urgent than this? For example, North Korea. Because if you were doing the indictment that Secretary Powell did yesterday of North Korea, do they have chemical weapons? Yes. Do they have biological weapons? Yes. Do we believe they actually have nuclear weapons? Yes. Are they about to be able to produce even more nuclear weapons? Yes. Well, why is Iraq then in the crosshair rather than Korea? Some people would ask. And secondly, other people would say, if he's had this material for this period of time and we've dealt with him in other ways, why is war now the answer to the predicament? So I think those questions were left kind of hanging or avoided, in effect.
And it's the urgency question that is raising these other issues about, well, if it's not what we already know, then what are the real motivations? Is it oil, or, you know, what else is happening here?
Yes, and I think particularly from a European perspective, but you can see this internationally. I saw at the Davos meetings recently where we had a broad group of, you know, international people, and with high degree of skepticism, trying to understand, well, tell me, explain again now, what is the difference between Iraq and Korea? To which the answer is, well, we're focused on Iraq.
All right. We want to take a call from one of our listeners now. Bill is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Bill?
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What's your question or comment?
The part of Colin Powell's speech that really disturbed me the most was his attempt to try to prove a connection between Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime. Since it's based on a connection through one individual, through Musa Abu al-Zarqawi, who is a completely unverifiable source, an individual that has been known for a long time to have been in Baghdad, but only to have been in the hospital, with no connections to any Iraqi officials. Mr. Powell, in his presentation, suggested that there was now an al-Zarqawi network, for heaven's sakes, that was operating throughout the Middle East and that was operating out of northeastern Iraq, not telling the delegates that this area in northeastern Iraq is a Kurdish area, and that the northeastern portion that he's talking about is the area that is dominated by al-Ansar al-Islam, which is a group that is absolutely opposed to the Saddam regime. And so the individuals just don't connect up. There really is no definitive connection between al-Zarqawi, between Saddam Hussein, this group Ansar al-Islam, and al-Qaeda. It is a total fantasy. And not only that, but this was all printed in the New York Times on February 2nd, 2 days before he gave his speech. So it is massively insulting to the United Nations to have our Secretary of State go before them and present a completely fabricated piece of intelligence and present it as if it were truth.
Okay, Bill, thanks for the comment. Graham, were those dots connected sufficiently, or was this an argument in search of evidence?
Well, I think that the point made was made very powerfully by the caller. The weakest part of the case, analytically for me, was the attempt to try to connect Saddam to Al Qaeda, and I think that the dots got fairly fuzzy, and even with spaces between them, as the argument was adduced. I think that I would say it's highly likely that there have been some contacts between some Al-Qaeda operatives and some Saddam agents, in that the enemy of my enemy is a friend, and so there's some business to be done. There's some contact actually between most intelligence communities and some people who live in back alleys like Al-Qaeda. So I think, and the fact that this fellow was treated in a hospital, I suspect you can find quite a number of Al-Qaeda operatives who've been treated in hospitals in Pakistan, which is part of the effort to fight Al-Qaeda, but is a complicated society as well. So I found that part of the argument the least persuasive, though it's very interesting if you take it in terms of public opinion and making the case for the war. The factor that's most important in the public mind in the U.S., as reported in the polls, is the connection between Saddam and 9/11. Which has been asserted, but as I say, unproved.
Just very quickly before we go to another caller, is it risky to raise Al-Qaeda as a red flag if you're then not able to conclusively make a case?
Well, I think there probably is a gap between the tests that the analytic or expert community applies, as the caller was commenting. So he's into a level of detail that probably washes over a very large part of the population, and for a large part of the population, the image of terrorism and 9/11 and Saddam all get somewhat confused, and I think that may be part of the marketing strategy for the effort, which turns out to be more successful than one would wish for a population that should be more careful about such assertions.
Let's go to Joyce now. She's calling in from Darlington, South Carolina. Hi, Joyce.
Hello there. Good conversation this morning. My one problem with all of this is that, you know, after 12 years of watching a shell game go on, you sort of tend to lose sight of what your goal was. I have problems with watching a shell game for a minute. For 12 years, your eyes get glazed, your mind goes numb, and you lose sight of what's going on.
By shell game, Joyce, you're talking about that famous, you know, pick whatever's underneath
right.
The shell, and then they're shuffling it all around?
Right, and that's what Iraq's been doing. Why are the European neighbors not noticing it? I have a theory that somehow or another they're benefiting from it. The ban is not 100%. It's not working.
Thank you, Joyce. Graham, what about that? Are the Europeans not paying attention the same way we are, or are they simply interpreting it differently?
Well, it's a very interesting question that Joyce raises. I think I think there's no question that there's a cat and mouse game or a shell game going on, and that Saddam has been relatively successful in hiding. I mean, the question is, why is the mouse not catching why is the cat not catching the mice, or not catching more of the mice? But I think from the European perspective, and from many of the people who are skeptical about war, the question is, what has Saddam done lately other than move his things around? He's been in his box for a decade in the war after 91. He's not attacked anybody. He's horrible to his own population. So that's certainly true. And he takes advantage of the sanctions that the UN imposes to blame the UN and the U.S. for the pains that he imposes on his own population. But he's kind of kept in a box under some control, and with the very intrusive inspections that are now going on, even more so. So the people who believe that war has to be the very, very, very last resort, given the damage that will be done by a war and the uncertainties about the outcome of the war and the uncertainty about what follows, prefer not keeping him in his box as a good alternative, but better than the choice of war. And I think it's a very difficult choice.
We now want to check in with Dr. Merhef Juzjadi, who is professor of political science at George Washington University. Hi, Dr. Juzjadi.
Hello.
We want to find out from you your sense of how this played in the Arab world, particularly from the average person on the street. We know what the official response has been, which is, this is ridiculous, this is nonsense. At least that's what we heard from the Iraqis, obviously. But what about through the rest of the region?
Well, through the rest of the region, they are not going to take very kindly, I think, to the presentation of Mr. Powell. I think there's a very, very deep resentment of U.S. Middle East policy. There is a heightened anti-Americanism as a result of the intifada in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza. And so the Arab street, in fact, does not want the United States to, in their eyes, to make further mischief in the area, namely to go to war against Iraq.
And especially in Syria. Now, Syria voted for the first resolution.
Correct.
And what's happening there now?
Well, in Syria, at the government level, at the official level, the wish, of course, is to give the inspectors time to finish their task. And so the question in Damascus right now is if the United States has that much information that was elaborated upon by Mr. Colin Powell, why does the U.S. Not give this information, or why has it not given it originally to the inspectors so as to facilitate their task? Syria wants all states that may have information, such as that given by the U.S., wants these states to give it to the inspectors, again, to facilitate their task so that they could go on doing their work in Iraq. Furthermore, Syria does not see, nor does anybody else see, for that matter, in the region, any deadlines in 1441. So why is war imminent? Why not give peace a chance? I think the big worry in Syria, and one that is shared throughout the region, is the potential chaos that will follow a war, the fragmentation of Iraq. Syria, like Turkey, also has a Kurdish minority whose appetite may be wet as a result of a potential establishment of a Kurdish autonomous entity in the north of Iraq. That fear, I think, is shared also in Saudi Arabia with regards to the south of Iraq, where the population is predominantly Shiite. And as we know, there is a large number of Shiites in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. So the fear in the area is the potential chaos that war is going to bring about. Furthermore, I think, in the region does not see Iraq to be the imminent threat as the U.S. is describing it out to be. After all, in their eyes, Saddam has been, and his regime certainly, and his army apparatus have been reduced in size following the Gulf War. He is far weaker now than he was 10, 12 years ago, and therefore does not represent the threat that the U.S. is making him out to be.
Dr. Juzjadi, let me ask you to hang with us for just a minute, but
sure.
I want to let Graham weigh in here as well.
Sure.
About these fears and perhaps even how important these might be to the need for a second U.N. resolution.
Well, I think that he's accurately, at least as far as I understand, characterized the complexity of the situation, particularly as it's viewed in the Arab populations in the region. Most of these regimes, the Saudi regime, the Syrian regime, the Iranian regime, barely hold control of a population that they know is a tiger that's about to run away from them at any time. So they're worried if something's done, and they're worried if something's not done, particularly if something big is done. They're worried about how it may have consequences within their own countries, in their populations, in provoking the street, in running the risk of territorial boundaries that were at least a little bit of stability in the region coming unglued, and especially that with respect to the Kurdish population that he referred to. So I think that the level of nervousness and fear in the region, as I watch it and see it, both from people whom I talk to there and from their press, is very high.
Then, Dr. Jujadi, let me pose the question to you. Does this really put Syria on the spot if there is a second resolution?
It is going to put it on the spot because, after all, Iraq this time around has not occupied foreign territory, has not invaded foreign territory. So really, there is no reason to go to war, especially if the inspectors and their task has become made easier by the cooperation of states. Now, if there's going to be a resolution, the regime is going to have to justify to its body politic why it would vote for the resolution, and that is going to be very difficult. If it votes against the resolution, it is going to have to jeopardize a budding relationship with Washington. My best guess is that in these difficult circumstances and in this balancing act that Syria is trying to do, on the one hand in favor of a fellow Arab state and on the other hand trying not to alienate the United States, my best guess is that Syria is going to be abstaining in potential resolution.
Well, it would be easy to see why that might be the case. It's certainly a tightrope that they seem to be walking, as you've outlined.
Oh, absolutely. You see, in the whole region, I believe the whole region wants the maintenance of the status quo, and that is, in their perception, Saddam Hussein, although odious and although none of the regimes like him, including Syria, Saddam Hussein is strong enough to keep Iraq united, yet weak enough not to destabilize the region. Now, with the determination of Washington, you know, there are ideas floating around about toppling Saddam Hussein from within, or having him go in exile somewhere. And here, I think it is reflective of their fear. What they want is a hegemonic power that holds
on to the government machinery.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Jujadi is adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute and adjunct professor of political science at George Washington University. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
r.org.
This is The Connection on National Public Radio. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, and with me in the studio is Graham Allison, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can join in the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And right now, let's check in with Robert, who's calling from Boston. Robert?
Yes, hello. I'm calling because I find your guest's use of the word masterful to describe Powell's speech yesterday a very dangerous term, and especially because your guest immediately recognized that the speech fell so far short of being bulletproof and answering the basic questions. Why I find it dangerous to call the speech masterful is that I think it buys into the right's redefinition of where the center is, and you have to accept Powell as being in the center, and that's dangerous.
Graham, you want to defend yourself?
Okay, that's a good challenge. I think I'd make two or three points, Robert, and see where we disagree. But I'd say, first, given the assignment, which was to make a case that will at least be powerfully circumstantial and compelling, given the evidence that was available, that he laid out a case in such a calm and measured and deliberate fashion that my bet is that as we go forward the next couple of weeks, even though it would not be my choice, my bet is that this will be a crucial plank in a successful effort to get a second resolution through the UN without a veto. So that'd be my first point. My second point is, who made this argument? And I think that's your point. Helps remind us. There was an interesting Gallup poll that I just saw the day before yesterday, and the question was, who do you trust when it comes to U.S. policy towards Iraq? Okay. Very interesting question. President Bush, 24%. Secretary Powell, 63%. So this is the most credible spokesman for the administration making this argument. The person who has done the most in diplomacy, who worked the hardest to get Bush to go through the UN, to get the 1441. So I think I would still stick by my masterful in terms of the objectives of the administration for this event.
Rob?
Well, you haven't convinced me. I'm extremely concerned that we, the Americans, including those that recognize this, fell far short of answering the questions. Feeling the need to call this a masterful speech is like the Germans of the 30s going home, seeing Hitler on the horizon, and saying, I don't know what I can do about it. I'm going to go home and have dinner.
All right.
And that's what you're doing by feeling the need to call Powell, who's on the right, calling him masterful.
Thanks for the comment, Rob. We appreciate it. We have Dave now, who's on the line from Medford, Massachusetts. Dave?
Yeah, hi. I'm calling regarding the common refrain we hear from critics of U.S. policy, which is let the inspections work. And I wonder if there really is an agreed-upon definition of the word work. That is, you know, if Hans Blix's team suddenly comes upon a large stash of anthrax or sarin or labs, will the international community then say yes to the U.S., you have a green light for war? Or would they come out and say, well, look, the inspections are working. Let them go on.
Very good question. And I think that for people who are not persuaded that war is the answer, a very substantial number of them would, if Blix was successful in disarming by finding material, which was then destroyed, and which Saddam would say, oh, my goodness, I don't know who left it there, would continue to argue that working means disarming Saddam. If they're disarming Saddam, let them continue their work. I think from the administration's point of view, however, if Saddam was shown to be non-cooperative in some very substantial fashion, which he might well be if the inspectors drove up to a facility which had the biological or chemical weapons that he thinks are most important, and he therefore sifted the inspectors, you would have a blatant material breach, and that blatant material breach would make it easier for the administration to make their case for war.
Dave, what's your sense of that? Would that satisfy you? Does there need to be some really strong trigger point for you to say, okay, fine, clearly we have to go in?
I think that Saddam is a master at hiding what he's doing, and I suspect we've already passed the trigger point. I'm just wondering what threshold the rest of the international community is looking for, and I suspect that they will resist actually taking any action almost to an extreme.
It's a good, I mean, the people who believe that the appropriate policy towards Saddam is to contain and deter would, I believe, as Dave says, take evidence that the inspectors were successfully disarming Saddam as confirmation of their view that we've got him on the run, we're squeezing him, we're disarming him, we're keeping him off balance, and we're keeping him in his box. And I think for people who have concluded that that's not the right policy, as the Bush administration has done, their case would be enhanced if they were able to show an unambiguous, blatant material breach by finding a substantial cache of biological weapons, or alternatively having Saddam simply kick out the inspectors or stiff the inspectors. And I think that since Blix and al-Baradei are going to Baghdad, I think, tomorrow, and then will make their report to the Security Council on next week, I think on the 14th. They will either say he's now turned over a new leaf and is going to be very cooperative and we think we're going to make great progress, or they'll say he's continuing to do his same old game, and I think that'll become the occasion when the administration pushes through successfully a Security Council resolution.
Thanks so much for the call, Dave. We're off now to Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, where Ken is calling from.
Hi, thanks very much for having me on. I think that Powell did a very good job of proving the case for more inspections. I'm not at all convinced that there's an active program in Iraq now. And one of the things that really struck me in his message was what we provided, the transcript of the Iraqis talking about trying to clear out the scrap areas, the surplus areas, the abandoned areas, to make sure they didn't have any leftover chemical-type munitions, not chemical weapons themselves, but just stuff that was used, like the warheads that we found. And they're saying, look in the garbage dump, basically. And that tells me that they're not actively really doing anything. And it's not an indication that we need to be going to war. It's an indication that there's maybe some more reason to pursue finding things. And I agree with the position of France that if this information, which is provocative, was available to the United States, then it should have been turned over to the inspectors. And it makes me distrust our sincerity in trying to disarm Iraq. I think we're just trying to come up with an excuse to invade Iraq.
Graham?
Well, I think that, that the administration, or at least substantial parts of the administration, have decided that that Iraq has to be disarmed completely and the regime changed in a fundamental fashion, and believe that the most appropriate way to do that is war. So I think we're on the path to war. That's certainly correct. Now, should Saddam decide to go into exile? Should one of the colonels decide to shoot him? Should Saddam have a conversion? I think that these are all very unlikely possibilities, and I think the third is the least likely. So I think the administration has pretty much made up its mind about that. And indeed, I think the president has made up his mind. And I think what we're now going through is the process of building international support for that effort. And I think the big issue going forward is whether the administration goes through the UN with a second Security Council resolution and thus with an international legitimacy on the one hand, or alternatively, if it's unable to get that Security Council resolution, whether it decides to go it alone, which I suspect it will do in the absence of a Security Council resolution. So I think that's where we are in the game at this stage.
Thanks for the call, Ken. Graham, I want to pursue that point about the credibility of the Security Council and indeed of the entire UN. If there are rules, and the United Nations has been telling Saddam he had to disarm for 12 years now, at what point does the UN become a paper tiger, I suppose, for lack of a better term?
Well, that's it. The question that President Bush, put to the UN on September 12th, when he went there last year, was either you stand up to Saddam and a decade of defiance, so let the UN not be a 98-pound weakling but stand up and enforce its resolutions, or you're choosing your own irrelevance and actors who are more powerful like the U.S. are going to act on our own. That actually put a bolt of lightning through the UN system and with diplomacy led to the unanimous Security Council Resolution 1441. Now we come up to a second test of this, and I think the good Bush administration wants very much to stay within the international legitimacy of the Security Council process, and I think the other members of the Security Council realize and value that process. So I think that one of the most powerful reasons why my bet is France will in the end go along is that between the two choices, they would prefer not to have just two options, but between the two options of the U.S. going it alone and or with the Brits and a coalition of the willing but no Security Council authority, and therefore the U.N. becoming less relevant and the UN remaining relevant and remaining a player, and France's veto being a powerful consideration for France, they'll end up going with the latter even as they hold their nose and complain.
And in fact, there have been reports of a French aircraft carrier on its way to the region, that French troops are being at least put on standby. So perhaps the public position is different from the private one.
Well, and I think that in the diplomacy that'll follow, there'll be enough in which France will be able to say they got this concession and this happened and that happened, so that I suspect the reason of state for France will turn out to be more powerful than the pique that they feel very strongly.
So now it's a bit about cutting a deal. I want to ask you also about timing. Because, as some reporters have pointed out, time is of the essence. Last year, the temperatures in Kuwait hit 100 degrees on April 7th. That has to be a consideration. So when these various folks are calling for more time, you have to wonder how much more time is there, really?
Well, I think the bargaining game that's going on right now between Saddam and the Bush administration is how long he can string it out, hoping to get into weather which becomes too warm. It's not impossible, but certainly difficult for U.S. troops to operate in chemical weapons garb once you get into April. So Saddam is trying to get a pass with respect to that, and will do his best, and therefore I suspect he'll become forthcoming to the UN inspectors, and the inspectors will come back and say, now the U-2s can fly over, and we can talk to the scientists. The Bush administration is running against a timetable, which, if you read the newspapers, look for an initiation of war sometime in the first week of March. I think the struggle will continue to that point, and I think the diplomacy will become very intense after Blix and al-Baradi come back from Baghdad and report to the UN next week.
I was going to say, any predictions as to what that report on February 14th might contain?
I think that Blix is in a pretty tough position because, and in his previous report, he sort of stood on one foot and on the other. He's a good public servant. He's a good civil servant. He wants to tell the truth. He understands that Saddam is actually playing cat and mouse game with him, but he hadn't been able to find anything. And what level of non-cooperation constitutes too much is be the question.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. We thank you so much. Thanks to all my guests. Graham Allison is director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We also heard earlier from Peter Philipp, chief correspondent for Deutsche Welle Radio, Masha Lipman, deputy editor of the Russian weekly news magazine Journal, and Dr. Marhif Zhujadi, adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation in our online forums at theconnection.org. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.